Welcome back to my last lecture. Maybe my last time teaching in 2023. Oh my God, it's a party. I thought I'd start with a few slides to get you guys warmed up for today's tutorial, which is happening this afternoon, where we have a data set that has been produced from the ground state of a Rydberg Atom quantum computer. And what you're tasked with doing in the tutorial is reconstructing the state in a very simple restrictive Boltzmann machine like we've been deriving in class. So I just pulled some random slides together just to maybe get us on all on the same footing. So just by way of review, here's the basic restrictive Boltzmann machine tilted on its side from the way I was drawing it. Sorry, my mouse is minuscule here. So I don't even know if it's visible. So on the your left-hand side is the visible units, which I was labeling with V, sorry, during lecture. I just called them X in this slide. And they're square, but there's no reason why they're square. These are all binary units. There you see the hidden layer on the right-hand side. Again, the number of hidden units is a hyperparameter. It's something you adjust to adjust the kind of representational capacity or the expressiveness of your machine. The joint distribution is defined there, P lambda. There's the same energy function that we defined with B and C as the weights and biases. And again, training the machine means adjusting the marginal distribution through those parameters, weights and biases, to approximate the unknown target distribution as close as possible. And the marginal is defined at bottom right there. Again, it's just a trace over H. So just by way of review of what we covered last time, block Gibbs sampling is kind of what we ended with in the sort of derivation. Again, the fact that the restricted Boltzmann machine is restricted gives it a lot of special properties. In particular, the fact that you can bounce back and forth between hiddens and visibles, to produce a Markov chain of samples. That Markov chain has some correlation sort of along it. And we'll talk more about that today. Each layer is updated with conditionals, which I've written there. The conditionals are conditionally independent, and so you can, again, update them in parallel. I didn't derive it, but I mentioned that there's an exact expression for the conditional distributions based on the sigmoid function, sigma, which I'll also talk about today. So there's the sigmoid and so on. And if you're familiar with feed-forward neural networks that use a nonlinear activation function, it's kind of fun to see the sigmoid appear in this context, but it has a different role as a nonlinearity. So one interpretation is sort of the firing rate of the neuron. It's not, in a feed-forward neural network, it's a nonlinearity through which kind of the function mapping occurs. So again, these are different than a typical feed-forward neural network. Training the RBM means tuning the machine parameters to minimize the difference between the marginal and the unknown. So we derived a sort of procedure for training based on the Kullback-Leibler divergence written here. I used small p instead of big p, sorry. There's my two distributions, right? And you can imagine trying to adjust the parameters of the machine so that p lambda in blue, overlaps somehow p of x. Right. There at the bottom, I've broken up the KL divergence into the two terms, the entropy of the data set on right, and then the sort of cross entropy, which measures, which holds the dependence on the parameters. And so, minimizing the KL divergence is somehow equivalent to minimizing a likelihood or maximizing the negative log likelihood. I got that wrong. But so L is our cost function again. It's the expectation value of log p lambda, in the distribution, given by the unknown target p. Training typically can occur through stochastic gradient descent. Again, this cost function defines, in some sense, the landscape that you have to optimize over, OK? okay? So I just, you know, I don't know, I threw up some sort of, you know, higher dimensional landscape. So you can imagine that if you start all your parameters randomly, all your weights and biases, you start out in some random position on this complex landscape. And what gradient descent is doing is trying to drive you down, you know, hopefully into the global minimum of that landscape. And of course, this is like, I don't know, I'd say the art in the state of the art is how do you optimize or how do you, you know, perform stochastic gradient descent in such a way that you get into, if not the global minimum, if there is such a thing, at least some sort of high quality local minimum in your loss landscape that results you know, sort of in, you know, a good recovery or of the distribution and good generalization to data vectors that you haven't seen before. And as I mentioned yesterday, the full gradient is typically too costly to calculate. So instead, some, you know, we sample some number of, you know, some smaller number, I guess I'm abusing small m here, but it's some subset of the data set, and you perform, you know, stochastic gradient descent, SGD as it's called. And what you hope is that even though you don't have the full gradient, that somehow that gradient signal with a, you know, a small enough mini batch is easy to calculate, like, you know, fast to calculate, and dry, you know, represents at least approximately the gradient that you're after, and so drives you towards that minimum. So the mini batch size is a hyperparameter, just like the learning rate and the number of hidden neurons and everything else. So again, that's something you have to tune by hand when you're training these types of neural networks. And this is the two terms that we derived yesterday, the positive and negative term. First one's easy to calculate, second one is intractable. And again, we discussed contrastive divergence, which again is you know, derived by Hinton. So this is fun. This is kind of one of the first things that we trained an RBM on, basically back in 2015, 2016, when Giacomo Torlai was first exploring RBMs. And so this is just a one-dimensional, simple, classical Ising model, you know, with a typical Ising Hamiltonian, and it's only six spins. And the reason we looked at six spins is it's something that we can easily calculate, say, the entropy of the data set for, and, you know, the full KL divergence and so on. So I very rarely show plots of the actual KL divergence as a function of training step, because we throw away that constant entropy term. But this is what it looks like in this case. And so on the left-hand side there, steps is the number of, you know, epochs, if you will, you know, training epochs. This is CD contrastive divergence 5, but I actually don't know the size of the mini batch. I already forgot. So, you know, there's a bunch of hyperparameters I already forgot here. But so what's going on is, again, you know, data was produced for the 1D Ising model, and we did it with a conventional Metropolis Monte Carlo simulation. So we got a whole bunch of data out of that simulation for six spins. And then we take that data, and using the method I just mentioned, we train, you know, we train the model using five steps for the negative phase. So when I have that block Gibbs Markov chain, we're basically just moving five steps along that chain, pulling that configuration and using that to estimate, you know, the intractable term of the cost function. So you can see it does pretty good on the right-hand side. This is just a plot of the probability distribution, you know, enumerated somehow in some binary way where, you know, we've just packed the six spins into a binary representation on the x-axis. And so the orange or whatever is the exact target distribution. And you can see the evolution of the distribution, you know, after 10 steps, where it's obviously not very good. That's the green. You see that it's not matching very well. And then after 500 steps of training, or, you know, 500 epochs, you see that it's basically converging very well, except for a couple of the valleys there. So,
how many samples were there?
I forget. I have to look at that paper.
It's like really close to the exact distribution.
It's enough samples that we should be able to do it exactly. So in this case, it's probably, I'm going to guess, tens of, like, 10 to the 5-ish or 10 to the 6-ish, something like that. For six spins, probably You want to get closer to a million, I would guess.
I was wondering about like overfitting. Is there some kind of problem where you might fit the empirical distribution better than the actual?
Yeah, it's a huge problem here if you don't have enough data. So, you know, how do you avoid overfitting? Overfitting occur, you know, which is in some sense a failure to generalize, right? Typically occurs when you have too many parameters and not enough data. So, you know, you really want to hit a sweet spot in your hyperparameters where you have enough, in this case, hidden units to be, you know, sufficiently expressive, so that if you're given enough data, you know, you can train all the weights and parameters. But you also, you know, if you have way too many parameters and not enough data, so if you overparameterize, then overfitting is a real problem. Yeah. So typically, I don't have an example handy, but what happens when you overfit is your KL divergence goes down and then back up again. That's what I see. I think we generally attribute that to overfitting. So it's, you know, it's something that you can see a signal for, at least.
You ever have like an extra term in the loss function that you add in to denote that? Or you just...
I mean, you can add some sorts of regularization, I suppose. But typically,
can
we
just increase the coefficient of KL divergence and emphasize more that you need the distribution to be like this.
I think if you're, you know, there's two kind of physical limits you butt up against. One is, you know, again, how many parameters do you need? So given the architecture, in this case, and given a complex distribution, you know, like, you know, a 6 or 100 spin Ising model, I think physically there's just a minimum number of hidden units required to faithfully represent that state, regardless of training. So that's one kind of physical limitation. The second is how much information is in your data set. Like if you have one sample or two samples, that's not what you would consider informationally complete, right? So for a given system size of whatever Hamiltonian and so on, you know, I think there's literally a minimum amount of data that's required to be informationally complete in terms of representing the state. So those two things you don't have much control of, or you don't have any control of. I mean, you can change the architecture to have control of the first one, but. So there's
Roger, can you quantify that minimum or a rough order?
Which minimum, sorry?
The amount of data.
It's different for every problem. It's literally, you know, it literally depends on the probability distribution that the target distribution P of X and how complex the correlations are between the variables.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, yeah.
So at minimum, the number of parameters in the model, and that should match the number of data points.
Bare minimum? It's maybe a good rule of thumb. But, I mean, if you imagine, you know, the overfitting thing is like, you imagine you have some sort of data and you're fitting a polynomial to it. I mean, that's good intuition, right? You have a certain number of parameters that parameterize the polynomial, and you want to make sure that you have more data or something like that so you don't overfit. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good intuition.
Yes. Yes.
But, you know, generally the amount of data required for some of these systems, it's, you know, it's just, you don't know until you try, or you may never know exactly what informational completeness looks like.
There's a rule of thumb in the internet, which is peculiar from the data analysis, that that you use around 10 times as much data.
Oh, yeah.
Like just a factor of 10 per data. So you want 10 data points per parameter, say, which, I mean, astrophysically speaking, we want a lot more data points per degree of freedom.
Right. I don't know if I would trust that rule of thumb for physical data. I don't know. What do you guys think? It sounds reasonable if you're thinking about natural data from the internet. But yeah, I would be careful if you're fitting these physical distributions.
You just came up with that number from cats and dogs.
Yeah, I could. That's, I can imagine that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yihong?
One thing is, it's overfitting a huge, as in like, the, because I tested these models, right? Like I've never really observed like overfitting, and the reason I think why I don't really observe overfitting even with a lot of parameters, it might not train well, but it never, like, I've never seen it increase.
I've seen it all the time in the RNNs fit with Rydberg data. Because we only have 1,000 shots from them.
I think the reason why I don't see it is because I train with complex wave functions.
Yeah.
And the reason why is that with complex wave functions, if your state is a physical state, there's a lot of constraints in the physical state. And so even if you have a lot of data, like the data distributions may not be possible for a physical state to represent. And so I do not observe overfitting there.
But if we take... 1,000 shots off of the Rydberg 256, atom machine, those 1,000 shots will give you overfitting.
Yeah, I see. I can see how that happens for like, if you consider a positive wave function.
Yep. Yep.
But like, in general.
So I'd imagine it also would occur in like an Ising model here too then, which is just a positive classical system. Okay, so once you train, what do you do with your machine? Well, that's kind of up to you. But one of the beauties of the RBM is that, you can produce, as I said, estimators. And so, you can train the machine, the weights and biases are fixed now, and you can sample it with the same Markov chain Monte Carlo procedure. And just, in principle, you can keep all the samples. And if you had some, observable, if you will, that was defined over both the hidden and visible layers, you could train it. You could calculate the estimator or the expectation value, using exactly what I wrote here. But again, if the, say support of that operator was only over your visible space, then, like I drive on the chalkboard, you can calculate physical observables by essentially just keeping the samples that come from the visible state. Okay. And so then you can ask, how do the, physical observables obtained from the RBM, match the expected or the exact values. And you can fool around with your hyperparameters and all sorts of stuff. And so the first time we looked at anything again, we looked at just a classical Ising model. It caused us a lot of what are we doing here with our lives? It's like we have a Monte Carlo that is producing data for an Ising model. Then we're taking a restricted Bolson machine, which is some sort of glorified Ising model, and fitting the parameters that and then to the data, and then we're like sampling the restricted Bolson machine. But I mean, you learn a lot by doing that actually. So here's 64 Ising spins. We've trained a model, and not with a full KL, but with just a log likelihood. And here's the results of sampling the restricted Bolson machine after training. And so what we're doing is we're calculating various observables. I've only shown the energy and the specific heat defined over the visible space, okay? And since we produced the data with a Monte Carlo, Markov chain Monte Carlo, we have, quote unquote, the exact values. So, the exact values of the energies, I have susceptibilities and magnetizations and everything here. So if you look at the energy plot on the left, you'll see how the number of hidden units affects, the results. So if you have, again, 64 visible units, one visible unit per Ising spin. And then if you have four hidden units, the energy actually is a very poor match above, 2.269-ish, which is the phase transition. Oh, sorry, this must be a 2D Ising model. That's why. 2.269 is the critical point for the 2D square lattice Ising model. So this is, I guess, an 8x8. So then you increase the hidden units to 16. And finally, to 64, you basically see the results converge to the exact values. So that adjusting that hyperparameter tells you the representational capacity required or something like that. So that tells you how many parameters you really need to get a faithful reproduction of the distribution. So it's somewhere between 16 and 64-ish. It's much more evident in the specific heat. So the specific heat. You see, if you only have four hidden units, there's a really big error associated with sampling the trained machine. And this goes down and down until it's basically converging to exact results for 64 hidden units. So you see the roughly here, if you have the same number of hidden units as visible units, it looks like the machine for this type of distribution anyway, even near the critical point, is sufficiently expressive. And we've done more work after this, and you know, it's not quite a one-to-one. You can probably go down to something like half the amount of hidden units for these types of systems. Half, you know, number of hidden is half the number of visible or something like that. But just an example of how, again, you adjust hyperparameters and you can compare the performance of the machine to see you know, what you need to do to get it to work. What you're going to do in your tutorial is learn wave functions. What's the difference between a wave function and a probability distribution? Well, in some cases, nothing, depending on the sign structure of your wave function. So in a very simple case, if your wave function is all real and positive in a chosen basis, then basically, you know, the amplitude, you know, or square, you know, the coefficients of the wave function are just square root of the probability distribution that you're learning. So it's just some Born rule distribution, right? If you have measurements in one basis, and that basis is all you require for informational completeness, those measurements, you know, that probability distribution is just psi squared. So that's very powerful, and I'll show you an example. But what it means is you can produce diagonal observables. So if you're in some basis and you sample your restricted Boltzmann machine, you can use those samples to produce diagonal observables, whatever that is. If you're in a SZ basis, SZ basis, you know, it could be any sort of magnetization or anything like that. But also, since you have access to, you know, the ratio of amplitudes, if you will, for different, you know, for different data vectors or for different states, I would guess, in the state space, you can also take your trained machine and use it to calculate off-diagonal observables. Okay, so if O, this operator, is off-diagonal, X and X prime are off-diagonal matrix elements, you can calculate off-diagonal observables. This is something really remarkable, I think. You can take measurements from a quantum computer and reconstruct, you know, the wave function. And then once you have that wave function reconstructed, you basically measure anything you want off of that reconstructed wave function. And just as a point, you can also handle the case where your wave functions have both an amplitude and a phase. Mohammed, will you talk about that at all? Because I won't. You will? Okay. So, good, you'll hear about it in the context of the RNNs. But basically, you can imagine that in addition to parameterizing the amplitude, you can have some other way of parameterizing a phase. And in the case of the restricted Boltzmann machine, I think it's very easy just to imagine another hidden layer, which somehow parameterizes this phi of mu. I've called it mu there. But there's all sorts of other schemes. And the big important point, if you're trying to learn a wave function that has complex amplitudes, is that you need measurements in more than one basis, right? And so your data set has to be, you know, if you're dealing with projective measurements in some computational basis, you also have to rotate away from that computational basis. So the loss function, there's different ways of imagining the loss function. But you know, a simple one is to just sum up all your log likelihoods for all the different basis settings, which can be an exponentially large number, I mean, although you don't know a priori. Actually, if you look on the archive, there's an awesome paper last week with Christine Mischick and Puya Roenig and Bill Koish from Montreal, where they used classical shadows or shadow tomography sort of as a cost function. So there's other ways of imagining constructing cost functions for complex wave functions. So we won't deal with that in this class because we're going to this tutorial coming up today, because we're going to reconstruct the state for our favorite neutral atom quantum computer built out of Rydberg atoms. So we have some data sets that you guys can explore, which are, you know, obtained through simulations of these strongly interacting so-called Rydberg atom arrays. A Rydberg atom is just a highly excited atomic state. So typically it's rubidium 87 they build these computers out of, although some computers also use strontium. What they do is they take optical tweezers, these green, I don't know, some schematic I stole off the internet, you know, where and optical tweezers trap these rubidium atoms, and then laser pulses are used to excite some of the you know, electrons into like n roughly 100 principal quantum number state. And so those are represented by those big balls, which is supposed to be like this, you know, this atom excited to its Rydberg state. They're strongly interacting, which I'll show you, and they have very high quality single atom resolved fluorescent measurements in these experiments. So you can provide projective measurements in the computational basis, which is the Rydberg basis. It's Rydberg or ground state. And it's fun because there are quite a few startups popping out of the woodwork, which are building these Rydberg atom machines. And you know, we can get real experimental data off of these things today. The Hamiltonian that underlies your tutorial of these Rydberg array machines is illustrated here. N is the diagonal, you know, it's the computational basis, and it's, you know, the diagonal terms of the Hamiltonian are written in terms of N, which is just the, you know, counting the number of Rydberg atoms or excited atoms. So it's just the occupation number of Rydberg states, if you will. So the if you forget the first term of that Hamiltonian, you would just have sort of a classical thing that looks like an Ising model. N's are zeros or ones, okay? The delta is like, think of it like a chemical potential or a magnetic field, which favors, depending on its sign, either lots of atoms in the Rydberg state or very few atoms in the Rydberg state. And the Vij is the interaction. So it actually decays as a 1 over R6 kind of van der Waal type potential in these systems. But because the atomic tweezers, which trap the atoms, can be moved into any arbitrary position, you know, you can adjust the interaction term essentially arbitrarily by designing different arrays. So that's fine. That's the kind of classical interactions. The quantum part of the Hamiltonian is the first term. And I've written this off-diagonal operator sigma x, which in kind of like the spin 1/2 notation. But really what it is the off-diagonal matrix element, which promotes you know, excitations from the ground state up to the Rydberg state or vice versa. So omega is the Rabi frequency, which has to do with the lasers of this in the system. So the lattice geometry, you know, what's the record for a Rydberg atom array? Anybody know? How many atoms have they trapped now?
1,000.
1,000? More than 1,000? 1,000. These are very large qubit systems now. I would say they got to be holding the record for, you know, I don't know how you measure it, but I could imagine thinking of some sort of quantum volume, I guess, or some sort of coherence time in these systems. But they're very very large arrays, arbitrary geometries, 1, 2, and 3 dimensions. Here's some actually couple-year-old pictures of atoms in arrays from the Harvard group and the French group. Here's three-dimensional lattices on the right. You can tell they're from the French group because of the Eiffel Tower. So the idea is that you're engineering interactions in these systems through the geometry of the array. And you know, you know, I think there's all sorts of interesting systems that can be studied experimentally here. The one, I would say, downside of these types of quantum computers is that they have a very slow shot rate. And to not get into details, basically those arrays are loaded you know, with some probabilistic you know, procedure. And so there has to be a step in every, I guess, every time you take a data vector where the optical tweezers have to be physically moved around, okay? That takes, I don't know, let's just say of the order of a second in these experiments. So you can produce a very large array, but you're getting data off of these things at, you know, at the rate of only one shot a second, which is 1,000 times slower than ions-ish, maybe 10, you know, which are themselves 1,000 times slower than superconducting circuits or something like that. So compared to other quantum computing architectures, these things are very data limited. So because they're data limited, I think it's a perfect place to explore, you know, state reconstruction with the methods that we're learning in this this class. Because what are you doing? You're taking some data. Maybe there's, you know, 1,000 or 10,000 elements in that data set. And you're introducing a wave function with some inductive bias, however you design it, you know, your RBM or your RNN or whatever. And you're hoping that by, you know, fitting the parameters to, you know, fitting the parameters to the data set, you're somehow interpolating that data that you don't have. Just like on the very first lecture, I drew that Gaussian, and I said, imagine you have some data, but it's kind of incomplete and imperfect. Fitting those parameters always gives you a better representation of the state than just, you know, reconstructing the histogram from the data. So that's kind of the hope here in these machines. So that's it. You will explore reconstruction of a Rydberg atom ground state in your tutorial. Here's an example of real experimental data that we reconstructed in 2019. This is, let's see, one-dimensional, I think it's an 8 or 9 site chain. So it's something we can do exact diagonalization on and understand the full quantum system. 3,000 projective measurements. I think there's more in your data set because probably they're synthetic. And we assume, and I didn't explain why, but it has to do with the structure of the Hamiltonian here, that the wave function in the occupation basis is all real and positive. So we reconstructed this with an RBM. And you can compare the experiment to, say, the neural network reconstruction, which is the RBM, for the occupation. The average occupation is a function of detuning on your left. And that's diagonal, so you can measure that directly from the experiment. But the off-diagonal operator, sigma x, can be reconstructed using this trick I mentioned, the local estimator, from the trained RBM. And so that would be, for your tutorial, that's essentially the ultimate goal, if you choose to accept the challenge, is to reconstruct an off-diagonal, expectation value of an off-diagonal operator using just the occupation data from the Rydberg state. So it'll look something like this. You can see there's exact diagonalization result on the right and the neural network reconstruction from the experimental data, but there's no direct experimental measure of sigma x. So I think that's kind of one of the long-term goals of this kind of strategy is to take experimental data, limited experimental data that has maybe even all sorts of noise and other things, and to reconstruct the state using these techniques that we're learning to help characterize and maybe design these experiments and so on. Okay? That's just a warm-up for this afternoon. Any questions on that? Everything's crystal clear. Good. Good.
Question.
Hey, I'm listening.
Are there any standardized techniques to dealing with noisy data?
Standardized approaches for dealing with noisy data? Anyone save me here? I'm going to say no. I mean, if you know a noise model, maybe there's some ways of mitigating data. Mitigating the noise, but I think the noise models are different for all of these different quantum computers. If you're thinking something more classical, I don't know. So one strategy that was developed here at Perimeter is to take noisy data into one of these generative models and then to assume you know that experimental Hamiltonian and to drive the optimization a bit further with variational objective functions or a variational loss function. So that's one way of kind of getting rid of noise, but in principle you could.
Roger, sometimes we use blind, if you don't want to do a noise model, can you do a blind noise removing, like a blind statistics?
I don't know what the blind part
is. This is the classical, not quantum, sorry. This is classical data.
What's the blind part there?
So you're as most as you're doing say foreground subtraction or any kind of systematic subtraction, you do you do as little assumptions on the properties of the noise as possible, and in the community is even very famous that the scientists themselves don't know. Which is the actual right model. So you put so many models into the data analysis consortium that anything, everything gets analyzed without knowing what is data and what was fake, to kind of remove the biases that you might have in the noise model. Does that make any sense?
Makes sense. Sorry. I think for natural data. Yeah, I think if you're thinking about spam errors in quantum computers, you probably think would like to think of something else. But yeah, no, I certainly agree with that. Lauren, I don't know how to turn on the board lights. Sorry. Yeah. Any other questions?
I have not a question. The last picture on your slide was from Santa Barbara. The background.
Oh, my computer. Yeah, like all my pictures are from Santa Barbara, which I'm where I'm going on Friday. Can't wait. Next week. I did my PhD in Santa Barbara, so yes. It's my home away from home. And actually, we started this, we were at the KITP in 2017, Torlai and I, and I think, you know, I sent him down to Caltech to meet Manuel Endres. Manuel Endres built probabilistic rearrangement, loading and rearrangement experiment for Misha Lukin's lab, I think, he basically invented the technology to enable the rearrangement of the optical tweezers through some algorithm. And he had just joined Caltech. So we got into this Rydberg atom quantum computing field basically through Manuel Endres. And so it was all thanks to KITP in Santa Barbara. It's crazy. Small world. Question?
On the last slide, you mentioned that the plots were generated with just like a neural network. Is there any specific blend in particular, or like
that was an RBM?
Okay.
That was all. That was, everything I showed you was a restricted Boltzmann machine. I forget the number of hidden units and everything, but I think the restricted Boltzmann machine was like no problem. It was, you know, by far sufficiently powerful to reconstruct. I think it was eight atoms there. So, I mean, if you can do hundreds or thousands of Ising spins, there's not too much of difference between the Ising model and the Rydberg system. But it's a good question, because we have, in the last couple years in this group, largely abandoned restricted Boltzmann machines for autoregressive models. So I kind of mentioned it at the start of my lecture on Monday. Mohammed will take you much farther down the autoregressive rabbit hole. But I got 20 minutes, and I'd like to maybe just give you kind of a brief warm-up for autoregressive models. And I want to introduce an architecture called a NADE, which is motivated by a restricted Boltzmann machine. But I'd say not in all that widespread use today, but I think kind of as a, if you're thinking of a pedagogy here, I think it's interesting to think of the NADE after the RBM and before you think about the RNN. Okay. So let me move on to autoregressive models and the NADE. And the NADE stands for Neural Autoregressive Distribution Estimator. I don't know if I want to write that. I'm not writing it. It was an architecture that was developed by the Bengios, Joshua Bengio, and La Rochelle and Murray. I think it's the same Murray from the textbook. La Rochelle was in University of Toronto at the time, and I think he's in Sherbrooke now. I'm not sure where he is. So this is very much a Canadian story. I mean, again, if you've been watching the news lately, Jeff Hinton's all over it. A lot of the work on these autoregressive models also came from giants here in the King's Domain. So again, an autoregressive model, I'm going to think of a joint distribution over a bunch of, say qubits or whatever is represented by this visible vector V. And remember, I broke this down for you before. Mohammed will use this extensively. So this chain rule of probabilities is something that's always true. And it's a very powerful, I don't know if there's consensus on this, but somehow I feel like this autoregressive property, the idea that you're mapping, you know, whatever this is, these visible units to a sequence, seems to be, I think, one of the you know, really powerful properties underlying today's large language models. I mean, it's there in RNNs and transformers and everything. It makes very much sense for kind of a language model where, I mean, we're always considering binary units here, zeros and ones. But if you imagine inputting a dictionary, you know, word that you're selecting from a dictionary, and then predicting the next word in a sentence, it's very clear why this autoregressive structure makes a lot of sense. So for example, I don't know, may probability of word two based on word one. May, well, it could be anything. I'm just drawing actually a recurrent neural network here, but I'm just showing you kind of the autoregressive property. Okay, what's the probability of word three based on the previous words? Force, right? B, and the more words that you start sampling from the dictionary, the more these probabilities will narrow, these conditional probabilities will narrow down. So if you're like, may the force be, and ask for the next word, if this thing's trained off the internet, it's certainly gonna complete may the force be with you based on how many Star Wars fans are out there. So maybe Muhammad will talk about it more, but oops, I crushed the chalk brush here. But it's autoregressive sequence, I would say mappings, are very powerful for natural language processes. And like I mentioned before, you know, if each one of these conditionals is normalized, which is easily possible, then through this root chain rule, the joint distribution that you're interested in will also be normalized. So this is why on the Ian Goodfellow taxonomy, autoregressive models fall under tractable density estimation. So you have an explicit parameterization, and you have a tractable density estimate for autoregressive models. But the restricted Boltzmann machine, you know, isn't in this category. So can the restricted Boltzmann machine be modified to be autoregressive? That's what I want to answer in 10 minutes. Okay. So how would you do that? Or this is the what Bengio and people in La Rochelle solved in the early 2000s. So the way you can imagine doing it is, right, you know, now think of the RBM. I won't redraw it. And imagine how a product of conditionals would look over the visible space. And I'm going to start using notation that's like, right? So if this is VI, then this is V, everything else, I'd say, let's call it less than I, right? And you can ask, well, are these conditionals tractable? So if each one of the conditionals was somehow tractable out of the RBM, then you could just break the thing up into some sort of sequence from 1 to n, the number of qubits, get these conditionals out. And I mean, there's different ways of looking at this, but really, what is a conditional? It's the joint, right? This is less than over V less than I. And I mean, somehow there's conservation of difficulty here. You can't really break up a RBM into a product of conditionals where each one of those conditionals is tractable. You're always going to be dealing with some sort of distribution like that. So we need an approximation. So still intractable. So what's the first approximation you should always do as a physicist? It's a mean field approximation. So the NAID, the neural autoregressive distribution estimator, is motivated by a mean field approximation to the restricted Boltzmann machine. Okay. So let's consider a mean field And I'm gonna kind of fly through this, but what is a mean field approximation? It's the assumption that if you have some sort of joint distribution over the variables A and B, that you know these are independent somehow. So when I talk about mean field, and I think when people in machine learning and statistics talk about mean field, it all boils down to that somehow. Okay, so for our RBM, if I wanted to construct a mean field theory, let me draw it the way I like now with hiddens here, visibles here, right? It's restricted, so we're connected between layers only. And if I wanted to pull out one of the VIs from a, you know, from my joint distribution, then let me separate this machine into that VI, everything less than it, so V less than I, and V greater than I. Now I'm going to go through this fast because I want to do it in 10 minutes. So I'm going to start getting real sloppy real quick here. But the point is to really just break up, you know, you're considering a VI, and now let's break up the the joint distributions of those three different categories, less than I, greater than I, and that makes up your mean field approximation. So what is that? So I'm going to approximate P, so it's a joint distribution between VI, V greater than I, and hiddens, conditioned on V less than I. Why am I conditioning on everything previous to I? It's because I want to write this in that autoregressive manner, okay? So I've set up the mean field approximation to take into account, let's say, the autoregressive structure, the sequence mapping. And so this, again, the philosophy of sequence mapping is really what's, I think, important here. When you take this thing, it could be a two-dimensional Ising model or a three-dimensional Eiffel Tower array. And what you do here is you essentially break up all the points on that lattice into a sequence from one to n. That's really it. So what am I going to do? I'm going to approximate this. Let me call the approximation Q. Hiddens, condition on everything less. And then this Q I'm going to write as the mean field theory, VI, Q, oh, I need the conditions. So everything's conditioned on V less than I, Q, V greater than I, right? Condition on V less than I, and Q, H, V less than I. Okay, and each one of these actually, so this one here, is because of the restricted Boltzmann machine, the restrictedness of it, you can break that up further into a product of conditionals, right? That's that one. And then this one, it's same thing. Product of HK. Not really important, but just a feature of the restricted Boltzmann machine. What can I do in 5 minutes? Let me just, okay, so how do you, how do you as a scientist, construct a new architecture from this type of thing? Well, I think it's a lot of, 90% inspiration and, 10% just fooling around with things. And so just let me tell you how, La Rochelle and Murray did it. So I'll give you the paper to read. archive 1605. So this is basically, you know, not that old. What they did is defined a Bernoulli variable, which I won't get into. I'll use the same notation as the paper in case you want to read it. Mu and tau to represent these conditional distributions. What is this? H. Right, so again, the mean field approximation says if you can just, you know, find an expression for these things numerically or whatever, you know, then that's all you need. You glue them all together, and hopefully that is your full joint distribution. So they just said, let's find a numerical procedure to, you know, quantify these conditionals. And found mu's and tau's via minimizing what? The only thing we know how to minimize, a KL divergence. And I won't write the whole thing. V greater than I and H Q, I'm not gonna write it all, log Q over P. So just put those expressions for Q and P in there. So what are you doing? You're basically asking, okay, you know, I've made an approximation and I've broken up my joint distributions, you know, via the RBM structure into something that makes sense as a mean field theory of the RBM. Now let's fit those Qs numerically, you know, such that you minimize the distance between the resulting distribution and the target distribution. The same thing we did in another context. So, I mean, I just really like the KL divergence. It seems so versatile in these types of calculations. You can do it, many things with it. So what these guys showed is there's actually a closed form solution, or there's a set of equations, so a solution exists, which I think is really cool. You know, you basically make this mean field. If we had a lot of time to work on it, we could work through the mean field theory, you know, minimize this as some optimization function and get a solution out. And this is what La Rochelle and Murray found, J-I. And I don't know if it's a coincidence or this is just how these things work, but it's expressed as a sigmoid function. This is for J greater than or equal to I. And I've written it as a sigmoid over weights and biases of the restricted Bolson machine. Okay, so that's mu and that's tau. I need a different index. And I'm gonna start to get way more sloppy here right away. For mu, there's one sum here. For tau, there's another one. J greater than I, weights, and Vj. So what does this equation tell you? There's an expression for mu that depends on tau, and there's an expression for tau that depends on mu. So you can't just solve those sets of equations. You have to find some trick to solve those equations. And that's, you know, if you can do that, then you have a mean field expression, you know, for the RBM. So what happens is, you know, I mean, we all have lots of experience with numerical methods. The strategy for this would be to, you know, solve it like a fixed point, you know, look for a fixed point, take some initial values, maybe zero, and then you iterate back and forth and you try to find a fixed point. So could try to find a fixed point numerically. And people have done that. You know, you can load those into a computer. initialize mu and tau, you know, to whatever you want. Oh, I should have put that one just above, sorry.
So the complexity of the problem, you make any solution.
Sorry.
Depending on the complexity of the problem, you make it any solution. I see.
Yep. And so actually what happens is, what did I do? Oh yeah, I'm erasing this one. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, people have explored, as far as I understand, you know, this fixed point iteration. It actually takes a lot of time. It takes something like minimum for a typical physical system. I think Isaac de Vloot did it for some of the Ising models, you know, at least 20 steps. And you know, you have to do it for every V of I, right? At every, you know, every set of weights and bias, you know, every iteration in your training. So it's actually hugely computationally expensive. So imagine 20 iterations back and forth, and you have, I don't know, how many visible units, and you know, have how many epochs. You can kind of see how that's not I don't know if it's intractable, but it's not really practical. You need to do this for every VI during training. Not practical. So what the NADE is, okay, now I'm just defining it, is a model of only one iteration of that, you know, fixed point iteration equation. So that is basically what it boils down to, and I'll draw it out. So the NADE is a model of one iteration. And it proceeds like this. You pick a mu, j, and this is my iteration. So I'm trying to solve those equations back and forth. First iteration, just set it to 0. Okay. If I set mu to 0, then I just look up there, and this gives me a tau. And I can call it tau 0, which is just that sigmoid. Again, sigmoid, C, K. And all I have is J less than I weights and V, J's here. Okay. So that's one iteration. You get an expression for tau, and then you should get, you know, one more step to give you bi plus k kj tau k, and what you're feeding in here is tau ki 0, the previous step. So if I kept going, I would have first iteration. Or sorry, zeroth iteration, first iteration, then I would feed this back into tau for tau 1 and so on. But what the NADE does is it just stops here. And it says, let's just look at this and try to get, you know, mu j, you know, through one iteration for every VI in that autoregressive sequence. And then how do you do that? I think the kind of crazy thing about the NADE, you know, derived in, or motivated by the RBM, is you naturally have nonlinear activation functions here defined, sigmoids, right? So you can model this as a feed-forward neural network. And I know that blows my mind. But that's what the NADE is. You take this one-step iteration, and write it as a feed-forward neural network. And I'm just going to draw it, and then we're done. I would say write this as many, you know, say n, there's one per visible unit, one per visible unit, feed forward And the input of the neural network will be the VIs or VJs. That's the bottom layer. Then you have an activation function, which is basically the, you know, this intermediate piece. And then the output will be this, which is your conditional probability Q. So let me just draw that. Wrong. And I mean, in our extended group here, actually, NAID was the first autoregressive architecture that people looked at. So we were actually training restricted Boltzmann machines with Juan Kereskija at Vector. And you know, he just knew about the NAID architecture from talking to these machine learning people. And he tried a very simple NAID architecture, and it ended up being more efficient and, you know, more powerful than the restricted Boltzmann machine. And so that really, in some sense, kickstarted us into Mohammed's whole PhD, which was autoregressive models and RNNs. So let me just draw this. So for example, one, you know, there's many feed-forward neural networks, but if I want to approximate, say, Q, V4, V3, V2, V1, right? So I want to have input to the NAID would be V1, V2, V3. Then I would have a hidden layer, okay, which is these nonlinear sigmoid activation functions. And so that's really the, you know, it's really the, I would call them C's. It's the taus, so it's C's plus, I don't know, some, I'm going to call it just W. What am I doing? VIs? Vs? OK, I'm just dropping everything here. Hs. OK, everything's. So you're taking inputs, and you're calculating a sigmoid. And then the output is the thing that you want, which is just mu. OK, so mu is equal to Q V4 conditioned on whatever. So mu is this thing here. So you input your Vs, and they're connected like a feed-forward neural network. And then the output is the conditional. And that's for one visible. Now let me take this square box and turn it on its side. OK? And let me draw the entire NAID for the entire visible space. OK? So here is some hidden units. I'll call them H1. Again, I'm just being really schematic here. In the first case, there's no input, and the output would be Q V1. Okay? The second feed-forward neural network, which you're learning all these nonlinear activations, would take V1. Did I do that right? Yeah, right? So I could sample that distribution for V1, and I can get an instance of it, for example, and input it. And then the output of this would be Q V2 conditioned on the input V1. OK, so it's like a smaller version of that. The next hidden units, and again, I've just written them like W, and there's another one. There's another W there. Those are what you're learning if you're training a NAID. You take V1 and V2. So you got to take V1 in and V2 in. And then you would output the conditional Q, V3, V2, V1, and so on. That's it. You build this thing up with all these different you know, hidden layers. And at the end, you have your autoregressive model. So the NAID is an autoregressive model that's been like, you know, tortured out of the RBM. And it has this structure. It has a, you know, very kind of, you know, I guess, flexible architecture in the sense that you can adjust the number of hidden units, so up to the expressiveness that you want. You can train it, train through, you know, the negative log likelihood. So the same cost function, L as before, and you know, gives you a normalized joint distribution output. I just wanted to go through that because I think it's really neat how you can start with an RBM, you know, think of a mean field theory, come up with some architecture that's, you know, by all accounts, a real, you know, rough approximation to the exact solution of some sort of RBM. Like, first off, you know, you've performed the mean field theory, you're assuming that it works, and then you're only, you're, you know, the iterative solution for the fixed point, you do a vast approximation of only doing that, like, one step of, or two, you know, one step of the iteration. Then you write that as, you know, that procedure as this neural network, and then basically backpropagate through it and train these feed-forward neural networks. And there, you have an autoregressive model based loosely on the RBM, which gives you this normalized output. So that's your first tractable density, you know, generative model. So I'm going to end it there. I'll take some questions, but I just wanted to say, you know, hopefully Mohammed will now show you a more powerful architecture based on a recurrent neural network that, you know, looks much more like you could imagine kind of a natural language processing model would look like. But I think, you know, just kind of illustrating the, I don't know, the thought process that goes into constructing these models, I think is super interesting. So questions?
So I want to be sure I got this right. So the number of hidden units
right
corresponds to the number of layers in your feedforward network.
So every one of these is this. Okay, so you have a bunch of visibles, and you know that second layer is the tau equation, because tau is, I guess that's not all that evident, but you know, you have a number of visibles, and then there's some weights and biases there, right? So every, you know, in principle, the latent space for the nade is adjustable. You can make it bigger or smaller, and if you shrink it down to one nonlinear activation function, that's called the fully visible sigmoid belief network, I think. That actually historically came before the nade. Fully visible sigmoid belief network. Let me just, fully, is that right? Fully visible sigmoid belief network. A limit of one, you know, one nonlinearity, one activation. So, I mean, historically, I mean, yeah, people did motivate the nade from the RBM, but there was a model, a previous autoregressive model that, you know, basically just doesn't have as much expressive power. And you can, once you have a fully visible sigmoid belief network with one unit, it's like having one hidden unit here. Yeah, it's almost obvious that you can expand that with multiple hidden units. So there's a nice connection between previous autoregressive architectures. Anna first?
I was just curious whether, like, the machine learning community was calling it a mean field approximation?
Or? Yeah, I think they were. Like, but I mean, the mean field, or sorry, the machine learning community is made up of a lot of physicists and statisticians, right? So I think there is a concept of mean field, certainly in stats. It's when you take a joint distribution and you assume that you can split it up, you know, into two, the product of two marginals or whatever, two distributions. Cool, right?
What kind of data does this model succeed and fail at modeling?
I think it could take it can take anything, basically. There's nades, or, you know, just Google nades and see what they're actually used in all sorts of, you know, topic modeling, and they're used to process text and all sorts of stuff. What Mohammed will show you is that, you know, you imagine again a natural language application where you're outputting words in a dictionary. And you can just keep going. So you can do sentence completion. You can, in principle, do translation and things like that. But I just think there's more powerful autoregressive architectures. And so, you know, people always use what's best, right? I mean, so there's certainly, I think, a lot of interest academically in the nade. But in practice, I don't see them used as much these days.
So we started with the restricted Boltzmann machine, where the weights are typically binary, right? 0 or 1?
No, the weights are real.
Okay, because I was wondering, because the weights.
Mm-hmm. No, the inputs are 0 or 1, but the parameters are real,
okay.
Real numbers.
Then
yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Sorry, Bhaskar.
The
meat becomes better and better because in the language of physicists, the interaction is long range because the connection between different units.
Decays, right? The correlation between different units, is that what you mean?
No, but they are all connected to begin. Everybody is connected.
Oh, and the RBM.
So meat right. becomes better and better.
Oh, I see. Because if it's an infinite dimensional...
Yeah.
All right, yeah. So the infinite dimensionalizing model or the infinite connectedizing model is the mean field limit, right?
Like Sherrington Kirkpatrick.
Sherrington Kirkpatrick, yeah. That's interesting. I never thought of that. Yeah, you're right. Hmm. Okay, lunchtime. You know, thanks for a fun three lectures, and I hope I've set you up for success with Mohammed. Enjoy today's tutorial, and thanks very much.